Hello, and welcome back to Our Bodies, Our Stories.
Today, we are going to be talking about intersex people and the importance of including intersex people when talking about reproductive justice.
As a content warning for this episode, we are going to be addressing non-consensual invasive surgeries, racism, genocide of intersex people, and sexual violence and coercion, specifically when it comes to children.
If you feel this could be triggering to you, feel free to skip this episode.
So, Amy, for the listeners that are unfamiliar, what is intersex?
Intersex is an umbrella term used to describe persons who, according to the Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, quote, do not fit typical binary notions of male or female bodies, unquote, due to chromosome patterns, gonads, or genitals.
So, essentially, to put this into simpler terms, this is anyone that falls outside of the sex binary due to any of their sex traits. And most people think that gender is socially constructed while sex in itself is biological, but the truth is that sex too is a broad spectrum, and it is also socially constructed and assigned different meanings by society. There's a wide range of different sex traits that you could have between just having a penis or a vulva.
Exactly. And fun fact, 2% of people in the United States are actually born intersex, even if all of these 2% of intersex people are not aware. For many, they could simply have different chromosomes than the sex characteristics that they develop.
For example, a person with XY chromosomes that has breasts, a clitoris, and a vagina, it could also include someone that was intersex but had surgery to remove any ambiguous genitalia at a young age.
Yes, and it also could include someone that has XY chromosomes and a penis, but begins developing breasts during puberty.
Right, so it's just a very broad umbrella term for people who fall outside of the sex binary and cannot be neatly categorized as, quote, male or female, unquote.
It can also be used to classify people with different medical conditions that cause them to have different chromosomal arrangements.
For example, Klinefelter syndrome, where a person has XXY chromosomes, or Turner syndrome, where a person only has an X chromosome, as opposed to XX or XY.
It also includes things like clitoromegaly, which is just an enlarged clitoris, or having a micropenis.
Yeah, it's important to remember that there are a lot of medical biases involved in what is considered to be, quote, normal. Overall, it encompasses a wide range of conditions and identities, but despite it being so common and so encompassing, intersex people and their experiences are often overlooked.
There are a lot of traumatizing and upsetting things that intersex people go through. For starters, in the documentary Intersection, which is available on Amazon Prime, intersex children frequently become victims of sexual violence and become targets for sexual predators.
This can be attributed to a lot of different things, but one thing that the people in the film mentioned is that intersex people, especially the ones with supposedly ambiguous genitalia, are taught from a young age to not talk about their bodies or their genitals, and are told not to talk about that part of themselves at all.
And sexual predators are good at targeting and victimizing vulnerable children. This puts intersex children at a higher risk.
Exactly. And with the increased medical intervention on them as well, they're never really properly educated about sex. And I doubt that they're even given a proper sex education, especially if the intersex person's parents did a non-consensual surgery on them when they were children. So they opt out their kids from sex education. And again, their kids are just left in the dark.
Yeah, exactly. And then even in addition to that, they also struggle with their sexual orientations, you know, this could be due to the intense gender dysphoria that can happen and the outside pressures to conform to the gender and sex binary. And so when you don't neatly fall into the gender or sex binary, then that can create confusions with someone's sexual orientation.
Right. And so this pressure is just so present in everyday life, especially growing up and being told you really only have two options for what you want to be. A lot of people in the film frequently talked about how they would see cisgender people's genitals, either by accident or when being intimate. And there's always a moment of, oh, mine don't look like that.
Yeah, and it is just so devastating to me that people can grow up almost with their own form of gender policing, either when it comes to their own genitals or when it comes to their gender, because they were never properly educated or they had non-consensual invasive surgeries, and then they have this weird relationship with gender and they're not able to fully explore that.
Exactly. And it all starts right from birth when some parents of intersex children perform non-consensual surgeries on them. It's important that parents who are wanting to love and embrace their intersex children need to be willing to face their own preconceptions about gender and gender roles.
Exactly. And everyone, including intersex people, trans people, non-binary people, cisgendered people, everyone is harmed by the gender binary.
Yeah, and this is something that Alok Menon said in one of their poems that I think describes this really well. They said that a world beyond the gender binary says no one else gets to tell you who you are. You get to figure that out yourself. A world beyond the gender binary says that there's no standard definition on what it means to be a man, what it means to be a woman, what it means to be non-binary, what it means to be trans. There is your definition. Show me. A world beyond the gender binary says that the purpose of being alive isn't to conform to pre-existing categories that were made in the 19th century as a way to control populations. The purpose of being alive is to be beautiful, and what beauty is being yourself.
Yeah, exactly. I couldn't put it better myself. Alok has a way with words. You know, just to sort of go off of that, the gender binary can be so harmful to everyone and not just intersex people. And going back to intersex surgeries, these surgeries largely exist in a rape culture. There's this idea that there's this thing that's done to you and that's it. And you're just left with this violation. And intersex justice and reproductive justice say, no, we get to reclaim what has been done to us and what has been taken away from us.
Right. And as we've said in previous episodes, reproductive justice is more encompassing than just abortion. It is also advocating for the right of intersex people to keep their reproductive organs and the genitalia that they are born with.
Yeah, you know, let intersex children grow up without any invasive and non-consensual surgeries. It is a violation to their right as people and their physical bodily integrity, and it can have long-term consequences on their right to health and their sexual and reproductive rights, particularly since they can severely impede people's fertility.
Exactly. I think that's so important to remember, because so many times intersex people are left out of the reproductive justice conversation, but performing a non-consensual surgery on someone means that they might grow up to be infertile, which means that they might not be able to have children the way that they would have wanted to. That is reproductive injustice.
Exactly, because a lot of times when these surgeries are done, they are removing sexual organs, like organs that produce gametes that lead to reproduction, and these surgeries are performed, and then the intersex person, or typically the intersex child, has no say in their own fertility, and it's taken away from them entirely.
And while talking about these non-consensual procedures and surgeries, it's also important to talk about their prevalence. According to the film Intersection, 5 non-consensual surgeries are performed on intersex children every day.
And even if that doesn't seem like a high number, over a lifetime, the amount of surgeries an intersex child could have on them is just astronomical.
And it does seem like a really high number. Like when you say 5 surgeries a day, imagine as a child spending your childhood, your summer vacation, your days after school in hospitals getting surgeries done on you when you have no idea what they mean and how that's going to affect your life. Like, that's a lot.
Exactly. And it's such a mental battle too, because you are young and you don't really understand what's happening. It's such a mental toll. It's not good for any part of an intersex child's health, their mental health or their physical health.
And from such a young age, you're taught that this part of yourself is, quote, wrong or, quote, incorrect, when that's just it's not true.
Yeah, and a lot of the times when doctors will present these surgeries to parents, you know, they're like, this is a genital deformity. And so you basically from birth, intersex people are told there is something different about you, which is
Yeah.
so wrong because they were just born, they exist, and society is coming in and telling them there is something different about you.
Exactly. This sex-based classification system has been created by human beings as a way to control people. It isn't something that's inherently, there isn't something that inherently makes you a man or a woman.
Exactly. And I wish that would have understood more, especially previously, because these intersex surgeries still happen today. And as we're talking about this, an intersex child could be getting basic, for lack of a better term, getting their genitals mutilated.
Yeah. So when talking about these surgeries, it's important to remember where the idea came from.
So, to give y'all a little bit of backstory, a Dr. John Money developed this method as a way of dealing with intersex children. In the 1950s, accompanied by a group of scientists at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, Dr. Money believed that gender was mostly about nurture rather than nature. And by using intersex children, he had found a way to prove his theory.
He wanted to show that if you raised a child as mostly masculine or mostly feminine, mostly like a boy or a girl, they would grow up with no, quote, gender issues and no, quote, sexual orientation unusualness, unquote.
And one of the most famous cases that Dr. Money used to sort of launch his theory was the Reamer case.
So basically, there were two twins, both born with penises, and one twin had the penis burned off in a botched circumcision. Dr. Money leapt at this idea and told the parents that they should change the baby's name and raise the child as a girl.
And so in adolescence, the child was happy, and so Dr. Money said it was a huge success and broadcasted his theory everywhere as a success.
However, as the child got older and learned the truth about what happened to that penis, they transitioned to be a man. But at that point, Dr. Money's theory was already so widespread and accepted that it was hard to undo the damage.
Yeah, and also because Dr. Money and his team worked for Johns Hopkins, which is such a prominent hospital with a lot of influence. The intersex surgeries became increasingly interventionist and aggressive because of all this influence that they had.
To put it into simple terms, Johns Hopkins had such a dominant voice and say that what they says goes, and that they said everyone must look clearly male or clearly female, and so the intersex surgeries on both babies and young children persisted.
And with more invasive intersex surgeries, some doctors became increasingly curious about intersex genitalia.
Some would even come into the patient's room while they were sleeping after an intersex surgery, or even before an intersex surgery, and lift up their gowns to look at the genitalia as if it was some grand mystery to be discovered, rather than a human being with emotions and the right to privacy.
That makes me sick. You know, it is so extremely invasive and immoral. You know, there should not be podiatrists, which are feet doctors, coming in to look at an intersex child's genitalia ever. There shouldn't be anyone looking at their genitalia unless it's for a necessary and consensual medical intervention, rather than just satisfying some sick curiosity that some doctor has.
Yeah, exactly. And because most of the time intersex surgeries are performed on children, the doctors that came in to look at the genitalia were looking at the genitalia of children. Children cannot consent in medical procedures, and I really doubt parents were allowing random doctors to come in and look at their child's genitalia unconsensually, especially because of the heavy stigma around it.
And speaking of this lack of the consent, the entire act of even performing these surgeries on a child's genitals, where they are removed reproductive organs, is entirely non-consensual.
And even if the parents consent, usually the child isn't the one deciding what they want. They aren't making that decision. And a lot of the times, these surgeries are actually medically unnecessary. Parents don't have enough information on what it means for that child to be intersex. They get this message from the doctors. The doctors can tell the parents that there's something, quote, wrong with the child's genitals, because evidently the parents notice that they look different. And what they typically say is that there is a, quote, deformity of the genitals, unquote, and that it can be, quote, easily fixed, unquote.
Yeah, and, you know, when you are a parent and then a doctor comes in and tells you that, hey, you know, this child that you just maybe birthed, there's a deformity, that word in and of itself is kind of scary. And it can be a scary to a new parent who, especially if they're talking to the person that birthed the child, there's a lot of hormones going on. And it's a very stressful time and a very emotional time. And then to have a doctor come in and say, there's a deformity, I'm not sure that's exactly a fair thing. And they're not fully educating the parents on what the quote deformity is, because it's not really a deformity, it's just something outside of the binary. And so they're like, oh no, this can't stay. And, you know, just sort of circling back, the thing that the doctor say is an easy fix is an entire fallacy. It's never just one easy surgery and suddenly the child lives a quote normal unquote life as either a man or a woman. It isn't that simple, and it never has been.
Exactly. Just to put it simply, normalization of unconsensual surgery on intersex children was a mistake.
Exactly. Exactly. These types of surgery should have never been normalized, as they are difficult on the child, difficult on the parents, and largely only done for cosmetic reasons.
Yeah, so there's absolutely no reason to begin hacking away at a newborn baby's or anyone's genitals unconsensually.
Yeah, and this is not to be applied the same to transgender children, because typically transgender children understand what is happening and why a procedure is being done, whereas intersex children are completely kept in the dark and just sort of told that this needs to happen rather than them having any sort of choice in the matter.
Yeah, I think there's a fine line when talking about this, because a lot of people argue that trans children cannot give consent to the surgeries, but there's a difference, because that is a choice that they're making. And I think really the key word here just is about whether it's a consensual action or not, because when someone does something to you without any knowledge or any information or anything, that is not okay. But when, even for intersex children themselves, if they want to have a gender affirming surgery later on in their life, when they have full information about who they are or who they want to be, that's great. It's great that we have care that can be given to children, to adults, to people if they want to transition into something else. But they should be the ones making that choice, not someone else.
Yeah, exactly. And I think one of the biggest things is legal consent versus giving the consent of the patient. Because for children, a lot of the times in the medical community, it really just comes down to whether or not the parents consent and not if the child does. So like you said again, it's kind of a fine line, because parents can consent for this intersex surgery on behalf of their child, but the child could have no idea what's going on. However, it's different when you're talking about a transgender child, where they do understand what's going on, and then the parents are just the ones to give the final legal consent. So it's a little bit of a different story, but as you said, it's just kind of important to take consent into account when we're talking about these surgeries, and that a lot of the time intersex children don't have any sort of say in the matter, whether or not there's legal consent there versus the patient's consent is a little,
so,
bit of a different story.
What it comes down to, not the procedure itself, but the lack of autonomy that everyone should be able to have. It should be your choice when something happens to you or something is done to you. That shouldn't even be what we're saying. Like, things shouldn't be done to you. It should be something that you want, something that you ask for. And when you look at it, It's interesting how the same ideas that want intersex children to be fit into the gender binaries, it's those same ideas that are against gender affirming care for people that want to change their gender or change their sex. And like, it's obvious. It's really, this can't be about what's good for the child or what's right. It really is just about maintaining power and taking away people's choice and autonomy.
Yeah, because, you know, when we're talking about intersex surgery to some child where the child doesn't really know what's happening to them, it is essentially a cosmetic surgery on a baby or a toddler or a young child. You know, it's different from if a surgery is necessary to save their life or if a child needs a heart transplant. But for a medically unnecessary procedure, it doesn't make sense to me why it was ever normalized or done without the patient's consent, like the intersex child's consent or anything like that, you know. But more than that, I think it's possible that these surgeries were just sort of covered up and there was so much stigma around it that it wasn't talked about, and then it just kept happening.
Yeah, and that's not to say that gender-affirming care isn't life-saving care. Gender-affirming care can be life-saving when it's something that is asked for, when it's something that is wanted, when there is full information to all parties.
Yeah,
and,
but...
Yeah.
Circling back, it's just sort of consent, and intersex children typically don't get to consent.
Exactly. And I think that's just a reflection of the socially stratified power structures that have and continue to allow cisgendered white men to maintain power and that continue to silence those who question them.
Yeah. And in other places, such as India, intersex people are a large part of society. And then, for example, in India, intersex people are commonly referred to as Hijras.
And this is true for a lot of other places. In the Philippines, they're also accepting of gender fluidity. The term bakla is used in the Philippines to describe people who have male sexual traits but identify as female and frequently show their gender through feminine conduct and dress.
Yeah. And in the past, bakla were typically seen as embodying both this masculinity and femininity, but they also frequently functioned as community leaders. And the acceptance of bakla fell with Western colonization, but there's still a bakla population in the Philippines and in New York City.
The Kalalai, Kalabai, and Bisu in Indonesia and in other parts of the globe, Mexico, Madagascar, indigenous North America, they all recognize third genders or genders that fall outside of the Western binary. And I think it's so important to remember that gender fluidity has always existed historically in so many cultures. For example, hundreds of years ago, under traditional Hindu culture, the Hijra community was once revered as demigods and were highly respected. However, when the British colonized India in the mid-19th century, they brought a strict sense of judgment, criminalizing what they said was, quote, carnal intercourse against the order of nature, unquote. And that was the beginning, scholars say, of the mainstream discomfort in India with homosexuality, transgender people, and Hijras.
Yeah, and Hijras frequently assume women's roles and claim to have either been castrated or to have been born that way. And they're believed to have the ability to bless or curse fertility. And in some cases, they're able to, quote, set up home, unquote, with male partners and adopted children. However, they experience a lot of pain, like psychological pain, as many Hijras can never actually birth children.
Yeah, according to Sushant Divgikar, the word Hijra comes from the word Hijar, which means the journey one takes to reach God, which is why this community is considered to have the power to bless people.
Yeah, and also it's important to note that Hijras are also not just limited to intersex people, and a lot of them are also transgender. And the Supreme Court of India recognized a third gender in 2014, and Hijras are considered to be a part of this group. And while the community is an important part of Indian culture, life in Indian cities is not always easy for them. they face a lot of discrimination and challenges, and there's a lot of activism and advocacy needed for intersex and transgender people in India.
Yeah. Lakshmi Narayan Tripathi, the first Hijra to represent Asia Pacific at the UN, noted in her book, Main Hijra, Main Lakshmi, that, quote, "The book is about my life. It has everything from the numerous love affairs I've had to finding solace in Mumbai's bars, from mental and physical abuse to finding a life of grace, dignity, and fame. It is about Lakshmi, a person who recognizes herself as a Hijra at present proudly."
Yeah, and her autobiography shares her story of struggle and the ordeal she faced while striving to become who she was. Having to deal with sexual abuse and verbal taunting, her family was never supportive of her sexual choices, but ultimately she found strength and understanding from her parents.
And despite her coming to be a success story, not every Hijra shares the same experience.
Yeah, Hijras were actually prohibited from performing in the public, donning female attire or feminine attire, and wearing jewelry. And if they disobeyed, they risked fines or imprisonment. And if they were wearing feminine attire jewelry, police might even shave their long hair and strip them. And although the patterns of police brutality remain unknown, they experienced police intimidation and coercion. According to historian Dr. Jessica Hinchy, the authorities would also take away children who were living with Hijras and, quote, rescue them from a life of infamy, unquote. If Hijras were living with a male child, they risked severe fines and jail.
Yeah, and once again, I think it's important to remember that a lot of this was a result of colonization and colonial and imperialistic ideas.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So the community, in response to the marginalization and oppression that they faced, petitioned for the freedom to play and dance in public places and give performances in fairs. According to Dr. Hinchy, the petition draws attention to the economic damage done by the prohibition on dances and shows. The people of the Ghazipur district cried out because they were famished in the middle of the 1870s.
And Dr. Hinchy said, quote, "The short-term aim of the law included cultural elimination of the Hijras through erasure of their public presence. The explicit long-term ambition was limiting and thus finally extinguishing the number of Hijras to many high-ranking colonial officials. The small Hijra community endangered the imperial enterprise and colonial authority," unquote.
Yeah, I think it's so important to remember that these people were a very important part of India's freedom struggle. And it's also important to remember that regardless of the oppression that they faced, they had so much community and strength and advocacy that really helped them get through the hardships that they faced.
Yeah, and Hijras are embraced by so many people in Indian communities, and they can bring blessings of fertility, as we mentioned earlier, and they are still crucial members of society. They deserve respect and love, and honestly, to be left to their own devices without fear of persecution.
I couldn't agree more.
Yeah. And so to sort of wrap this up, this has been a lot of information in this episode, but intersex justice is all-encompassing. What you, as a listener, can do is advocate for acceptance in education and speak out against these non-consensual surgeries that are performed on intersex children.
I agree. And if you ever find yourself the parent of an intersex child, loving and accepting them within the framework of intersex justice will require you to be willing to face your own internalized biases around gender and gender roles. And honestly, this is true for parenting any child. If you decide to have a child, it's so, so important to be aware of your own biases around gender, around sex, around sexual orientation, because putting those biases that you have onto your child can be so harmful for their health, their development, their happiness.
Yeah, exactly. And everyone is harmed from the gender binary. And if someone is a parent of an intersex child, they don't need to be their child's first bully. They don't need to be clipping their wings and telling them that there is something different about you and making them undergo these procedures when there's really no medical reason for it.
And Again, I think that's important for all parents to remember. Everyone has their own biases, but it's important to reflect on these to ensure that you put your child first.
Yeah, exactly. And then when I consider intersex justice over the long term, I picture intersex people existing, you know, in an ecosystem, an orbit, or a stratosphere of connections that truly see them, affirm them on their path, and encourage them to continue their journey in a way that is not stigmatizing and actually represents the whole person.
Intersex people aren't uncommon. They're just unrecognized. Statistically speaking, if you know a redhead, you also know an intersex person.
It's the same percentage of people in the world. 2% of the population is a redhead, and also 2% of the population is also intersex.
And if you're interested in learning more, the short film we mentioned earlier, Intersection, is available for free on Tubi and also available on Amazon Prime. It's a great one to get started with.
Yeah, and that short film also gives a spotlight to people that are intersex and allow them to talk about their stories, which is extremely powerful and moving.
Yeah, it was created by an intersex person, so it's definitely a real, authentic, raw, true experience of what they undergo.
Yeah, exactly. And so additionally, if you are also wanting to learn more, there are some Instagram accounts that post great content surrounding intersex people and other content. Alec V. Menon is someone that we have recommended before and that we will continue to recommend. They're great. And also ISNA, with ISNA, which is the Intersex Society of North America. They have an encyclopedia online with terms and resources. And they also have a tab that could connect you to a support group if you are an intersex person.
So that's all that we have for you today. Make sure to subscribe to our podcast and fill out the suggestions Google form in the description of this episode. Follow us on Instagram and feel free to comment or DM us if you have any thoughts or suggestions. Our Instagram is @RJVela.
And make sure to tune in for the next episode.